Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, and may be seated. The first case on our calendar is 03-647, State of Ohio versus James T. Conway III. Mr. Grafe.
Good morning, members of the court, counsel. My name is Todd Barstow. I represent Mr. Conway along with Mr. Grafe. Mr. Grafe, we're going to split our argument this morning, and Mr. Grafe will follow argue.
Should have let the.
I apologize.
Know that. Okay. Thank you.
Sure. I'm going to be concentrating on propositions of law 1, 3, and 4 this morning. Proposition of law 1 was our argument that the court erred in not giving a voluntary manslaughter instruction in this case. And we believe that the evidence was pretty clear and pretty convincing that this was a possible case for voluntary manslaughter. Involuntary manslaughter is a crime of inferior degree to aggravated murder, and the court did give a murder instruction in this case. But the test is both a subjective and an objective test. The subjective portion being, did the defendant in a particular case, or in this case, Mr. Conway, act under a sudden passion or fit of rage? And the objective part would be, could a reasonable jury acquit on the more serious charges and convict on the voluntary manslaughter charge? Or, in essence, could a reasonable jury, believe, find convincing the evidence of provocation? The first question we think should be answered is, was the provocation reasonable, an objective standard? And in this case, the undisputed facts are that Mr. Conway's brother was stabbed after a pretty serious, very serious altercation in the parking lot of a nightclub here in Columbus. The state's testimony was that there were 40 to 50 people involved in a fight out in the parking lot. The bouncers could not control it. They had to contact the Columbus Police Department, who responded with a number of officers. There were racial epithets being thrown about on both sides. This was a fight between apparently some African Americans and some whites. This disagreement, some of this argument and bitterness had gone back a number of years. Some of these people had gone to high school together, and so this was apparently something of long standing. So in the context of this, in the terms of a fight where there were very heated passions and then Mr. Conway's brother was stabbed, we believe that objectively that is serious provocation if your sibling is stabbed and you're just a few feet away. The second question that should be asked is, was the defendant provoked, or should he have been provoked? And again, the answer to this is yes, and the defendant's own actions and the testimony of the state's witnesses describe how once he had ascertained the stabber, who readily admitted to stabbing Mr. Conway's brother at trial, once James Conway had identified this person, he immediately produced a firearm and shot at Mr. Williams. So again, we believe that the provocation was palpable. The third question that the trial court should consider was, would a reasonable person have cooled down between the provocation and the act? And again, we believe the answer is no. The provocation was of course the stabbing and in the context of this large fight, and then the act of shooting, and they happened very, very close in time.
But there was an intervening act of going to the car to retrieve the weapon and then returning to the scene before it was discharged. Isn't that what the fact showed?
Well, there's some dispute over that, Your Honor.
You didn't go to the vehicle to get the weapon and then return?
There was testimony, as I recall, from Mr. Conway's own testimony, was that someone gave him the firearm. There was also testimony that he had gone to a car which was parked on the street or in the parking lot, right in the vicinity of the stabbing, and retrieved a firearm. But even so, it depends on which version of that that the trial court would have accepted. If the court accepts the version that Mr. Conway went to a car and procured a firearm, there was very little time that elapsed between the stabbing, the realization that his brother had been stabbed, and the procuring of the firearm, because the testimony is that these cars were parked in the parking lot or right on the street. I don't recall, but it was very close by. So even if that's what happened, Mr. Conway went and produced a firearm, it was still a very short time. And the question is, would a reasonable person have cooled down, have calmed down between the provocation and the time of the act? And we believe in this case, no, there wasn't sufficient time because of the charged up atmosphere of this parking lot brawl, which is the backdrop for the whole case. And finally, the subjective question, the final question is, did the defendant in a particular case, or in this case, Mr. Conway, cool off between the provocation and the act? And we believe the answer to that question is no, no matter how you look at the facts, as the question was just posed, whether Mr. Conway went and got the firearm or whether someone gave it to him right there as he was standing in the parking lot, a very short amount of time had elapsed between the two events. So again, we believe that the court, there was ample evidence of voluntary manslaughter in this case, and the trial court should have given that instruction as was requested by the defense. Proposition of Law 3 concerns the failure to have Mr. Conway present at critical stages of the trial. And in this case, the critical stage is the jury instruction conference, which occurred obviously at the end of the evidence portion of this case. It appears from the record, at least from what the trial judge put in the record, that there was a 3.5 hour, all told, jury instruction conference that was held off the record without Mr. Conway present. This was apparently broken up over parts of 2 days, with approximately 2 hours on one day in the afternoon and then an hour and a half the following morning. And once the court came back into session after the hour and a half morning conference, Mr. Conway complained to the court that he had not been present during this jury instruction conference, which had occurred. There appears to be no waiver of his presence during this conference. And the question is this a critical stage of the proceedings? We've cited, we believe, ample case law, Illinois versus Allen, State versus Taylor, State versus Hill, that indicate that the rule is that the defendant should be present at all stages of his or her trial, and that that's the presumption. That's the goal, is that the defendant will be present during all stages. The state has cited a case, State versus Howard, which indicates that it's okay not to have the defendant present only if questions of law are being discussed. But in this case, we can assume that the lesser offenses, the instructions on the lesser offenses were included, including, we could assume, I think safely, some discussion on the voluntary manslaughter and involuntary manslaughter instructions, which weren't given, but we may assume that they could have been discussed.
Counsel, when the defendant raised the issue with the judge, did the judge give an explanation of what had occurred at the jury instruction conference?
I believe he did. I believe he did give an overview of what had happened at the conference, and I don't believe that satisfied, it didn't seem, at least in my view, to satisfy Mr. Conway. He appeared to have wanted to have been there.
Were there questions, though, that he asked that weren't answered by the judge?
I believe that his questions were answered. Yes, ma'am. I believe the judge honestly did his best to answer questions that Mr. Conway posed concerning what had happened at the conference.
Mm-hmm. You're just saying that it's a critical proceeding. He should have been there, and you're not interested in what your client could have offered at the time. Your point is that he should have been present at a critical proceeding. Is that it?
Yes, ma'am. He should have been present. And again, sort of the other part of the question that you asked, what could he have offered? Since we don't know for sure what was discussed at the conference or how it was discussed or anything, since it wasn't on the record, it's difficult to say for sure if Mr. Conway could have helped, absolutely. But these are important, especially in a capital case, and especially in a case that is this serious. Jury instructions are very, very important. They're a very critical part of what happens at the end of a capital case.
So you would have us say that this is a critical proceeding and that any time there are going to be instructions discussed in a capital case that the defendant must be present?
Well, yes, and especially if it's going to be a discussion of 3.5 hours. This wasn't just a sidebar conference or a quick question or two on the record about technical parts of the instructions or a misspelling or a Scrivener's error or something like this. A 3.5 hour conference, we can assume that it was a pretty serious conference.
Normally in a capital case, the judge will say, do you waive the presence of your client? Was that done in this case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't remember it being in the record that where the where Mr. Conway's presence was waived by trial counsel.
Did his counsel request his presence? Did he object at the time that the conference was proceeding and state that he wanted his client brought to the proceedings?
Your Honor, my recollection of the record is that there is nothing about that in the record.
So the answer is no. He didn't.
No, yes, ma'am.
He did not object. Counsel for the defendant did not object to his client's absence during this conferencing.
I don't believe so.
Isn't that a waiver?
Well, I suppose you could argue that you can make an argument that it's a waiver that by not insisting that Mr. Conway be present, he implicitly waived. But again, we're talking about a capital case where we think those things should be affirmatively on the record.
Have you included that as a point on ineffective assistance of counsel? Is that raised here or not?
I believe it is. Yes. I guess really the bottom line on this is, if it's your life that's on the line, if you're facing the death penalty, I suppose to you it would be a critical stage. And finally, proposition of law 4, character evidence. The state called a gentleman named Benjamin Bechtel to testify in their case in chief. And most of Mr. Bechtel's testimony was not probative. It was background evidence as to Jason Gervais, the young man who was killed at the scene. Mr. Bechtel didn't see the fight. He wasn't in the parking lot. He didn't see Mr. Gervais be killed. He didn't even realize that Jason had been tragically killed until the next day when I believe he heard it in a news report, or I believe a friend had told him. What this really is a very subtle victim impact statement that was brought in the case in chief. Now the state cites State versus Combs in their brief for the proposition that this sort of thing is permissible. And in Combs, the prosecutor in his closing argument in a case from Hamilton County in the penalty phase closing, talked about the value of people's lives, and he came right out and said, whose life is more valuable, the two lives of the people who were killed or the life of this defendant who likes to live life in the fast lane? That's a pretty heavy-handed approach to this type of evidence, and this court criticized that prosecutor and found that he had committed error, although I believe the court found it to be harmless error. But the prosecutor in this case was much more subtle. The prosecutor in this case didn't stand up in front of the jury in closing argument or in opening and make an argument about what a wonderful young man Jason Gervais was, which was what's the testimony that Mr. Bechtel brought to this case, was that Mr. Gervais was this very hardworking, very nice young man who had just had some business success and was out to enjoy an evening with friends and wasn't involved in any way with the altercation between Mr. Conway and the other gentleman at the bar. And we don't dispute any of that Mr. Bechtel was making this up or anything like that. It's all true, we assume. No, nothing in the record says it's otherwise.
Well, counsel, how does that show to a reasonable probability that the outcome of the jury's verdict would have been different with or without this character, if you want to classify it as character testimony, how does that impact on the conviction?
Well, Your Honor, it impacts on the conviction because it shows, as the prosecutor in Combs was trying to show, that we want the jury to consider this non-statutory aggravating factor, that the victim's life is worth more than the defendant's life. And that's a very important calculus in jury consideration. And we think that in this case, that was a factor that weighed very subtly, but it was there, that weighed in the jury's ultimate decision in this case.
But you have no proof of that, no evidence, nothing to offer other than the fact that these words were spoken by Mr. Bechtel, the witness, and gave some history as to the relationship and who this person was that was killed at
That's
the
correct.
Scene. But other than that, you've got nothing to link that description of the victim to the activities of your client that evening.
Well, I don't believe there was any link. I'm not sure I understand the question, ma'am.
Well, I'm trying to understand who this victim was, what his activities were, what his relationship was to the witness, has any impact on the activities of your client that evening for which he was convicted.
Well, it doesn't, because I don't believe that there's any evidence that Mr. Conway and Mr. Gervais knew each other. I don't believe there's no evidence that they knew each other. That's not what the argument is about. The argument is about the introduction of victim impact type evidence into the case where that's not proper.
Okay.
That's not the issue. We're not.
Whether it was proper or not for him to describe who this victim was, again, going back to my original question, where's the reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different for your client had this testimony not been introduced?
Well, we believe this is not proper evidence. And we don't have any more argument in this case, Your Honor, than the appellant did in the Combs case, where this court found that the prosecutor's very heavy-handed comments were erroneous, were in error. So we have no more evidence than in the Combs case.
Which was harmless in the Combs case.
It was harmless.
And we could draw the same conclusion that this is harmless error.
Well, we would hope that you wouldn't, but you could. Yes, ma'am. Okay. I see that I'm out of time, and Mr. Grafe will take the balance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barstow. Mr. Grafe.
Thank you, sir. My name is David Grafe. May I ask for a couple minutes of rebuttal, sir?
Well, if you watch your time, you'll get it. When the yellow light comes on, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Okay. I see where I have about 12 and a half
you have
minutes.
About 12 and a half minutes right now.
I represent Mr. Conway also, and I'm going to concentrate on the last 10 of the assignments of error. If the court wishes. The first issue deals with issue 10, which is basically the law of transferred intent that permeated this entire case. Just to set the stage, the indictment involved two counts that are at issue in this transferred intent problem. The second count of the indictment was a charge of attempted murder. The first count was the murder with prior calculation and design. The jury instructions that Judge McGrath gave to the jury dealt with, the attempted murder and the transferred intent. He stated that the transferred intent issue only involves purpose, the element of purpose. And in the facts of the case, the jury obviously found Mr. Conway guilty of attempted murder, not attempted aggravated murder. So what occurred with the judge instructing on the law of transferred intent The jury was left with no other alternative but, again, to find the defendant guilty of attempted murder without the crucial element of prior calculation and design. The case that has been recently decided about 2 or 3 years ago from the United States Supreme Court is at issue also in this, issue number 10, and that deals with Ring versus Arizona. In that case, the case was reversed on behalf of Mr. Ring because of the fact that the judge found an aggravating circumstance which the jury could not find because of the particular circumstance in the Arizona state court system. The judge, Justice Ginsburg, reversed the case because of the fact that again, the factual determination in the Arizona case had to be made by the judge before he could find Mr. Ring through the sentence of death. There is no difference between this case and that case, again, because the judge in Mr. Conway's case instructed the jury on transferred intent. Again, the only way the jury could have found Mr. Conway guilty of prior calculation and design is if the indictment had read attempted aggravated murder instead of attempted murder. The jury instruction that Judge McGrath again issued dealt with purpose. It did not deal with prior calculation and design. The other important fact that is mentioned in Judge McGrath's decision, which is on page 15 of his decision in the appendix, is that he made a factual determination that Jason Conway or James Conway used prior calculation and design, or his conduct included prior calculation and design when he shot both at Mandel Williams and Jason Gervis.
Counsel, just so I understand, are you saying there was no jury instruction given on prior calculation and design?
There was a jury instruction that was given on prior calculation and design, but the jury instruction dealing with transferred intent and with attempted murder did not include the issue of prior calculation and
design. So you're complaining about the format of the jury instructions. However, the prior calc and design was potentially considered by the jury, was it not? If it was in the instructions, the jury had the potential to consider it.
The jury had the potential to consider prior calculation and design, but it's impossible for them to make the factual determination that Mr. Conway used prior calculation and design against Jason Gervis. And the reason is because you have attempted murder here. You don't have attempted aggravated murder. In the State versus Soul case, which is from this court, he was indicted under aggravated murder and attempted aggravated murder. And the issue was transferred intent. And here, in this case, Judge McGrath specifically said the only way that you can find Mr. Conway guilty of aggravated murder is through the conduit of attempted murder. In other words, we have attempted murder here, we have aggravated murder here, transferred intent is the conduit. You only transfer what you have on attempted murder. You cannot transfer anything more. Ring versus Arizona is on all fours here. The only difference is it was an aggravating circumstance in Arizona, which they said, which Justice Ginsburg said, is an element of the law of capital litigation. So if you have if this were attempted aggravated murder, the prosecution calls this a clerical error. The grand jury heard this case, and they issued an indictment that said attempted murder instead of attempted aggravated murder. So therefore, the only pathway to get to the prior count is through the transferred intent doctrine. The same goes for the next assignment of error, which deals with the course of conduct only. It's a little bit different. Again, Judge McGrath said that the doctrine of transferred intent is involved in the course of conduct specification. What he did was he created a situation where the jury was only allowed to hear what we call a singular purpose. In other words, the intent dealing with the transferred intent created a singular purpose, and therefore the course of conduct is vitiated. It's gone. And normally the course of conduct involves situations like this or time pass in between. But in this case, because he stated specifically that the law of transferred intent applies to course of conduct like it did to the first issue, then we have the situation where we're only talking about one intent here, one purpose. Real quickly, if the court has no further questions on this, because I think these two issues are extremely crucial to Mr. Conway. The other issue that's really important here is Judge McGrath said that this fellow named Trent was a government agent on May 16th of 2002. Conway was arrested on February 23rd, 2002. They spent time in the jail together. Conway talked to him and so forth. Then after May 16th of 2002, there were a series of tapes from 5:17 until 5:24. These series of tapes created new crimes. They created consciousness of guilt and so forth. The prosecutor is saying, and Judge McGrath is saying, that all this relates back to the time before he was a government agent. We're saying that that is absolutely wrong, and that is prejudicial because of the fact that the stage in this case was set by the law enforcement officials. They created crimes so that Mr. Conway would be assured of being found guilty here. The tapes are extremely important, and we are saying that they should never have been admitted or allowed to be used in both the direct examination of Mr. Trent and also the cross-examination of him. I have about 2 minutes left, and I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Grave. Ms. Coriel.
Good morning, Your Honors, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. My name is Jennifer Coriel, and I, along with Susan Day, represent the state of Ohio. We do intend to split up our argument, and if it pleases the Court, I will be addressing issues 2, 3, 12, 13, and 16 through 18. With respect to the sufficiency of the evidence, when viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution in this state, there was sufficient evidence to convict the defendant of aggravated murder with the death specifications. When looking at the required mental state to determine whether or not the defendant...
Counsel, who's going to address the voluntary manslaughter?
Ms. Day is, Your Honor. When reviewing the required mental state, we must look at the totality of the circumstances surrounding the crime to determine whether or not the defendant had the purpose to kill and whether or not there was prior calculation and design in committing this crime. While prior calculation requires more than instantaneous deliberation, this court has held that it does not require a drawn-out thought process. In State versus Taylor, this court held that a time frame of 2 to 3 minutes was sufficient for prior calculation and design to be developed. In State versus Robbins, this court held prior calculation and design was found where the defendant assaulted a victim, went back into his apartment, grabbed a sword, and instants later came back out and stabbed the victim. These were not impulsive shootings in this case. The defendant fired 8 shots at Mandel Williams and Jason Jervis and killed Jason Jervis with a shot to his chest. The defendant admitted to Ronald Trent during one of their conversations that he cocked the gun back to make sure that it was loaded, that he just started firing, that he saw Jason Jervis run in front of Mandel Williams, and that he kept firing because, quote, it was a 45, I knew it would go through him, and he kept firing. In State versus Hutton, this court held that multiple gunshot wounds to a victim's body can be strong evidence of prior calculation and design, and also multiple close gunshot wounds to vital areas demonstrate a purpose to kill, and that was in both State versus Treach and State versus Palmer. Moving on to assignment of error three, as to whether critical stages of the proceedings were conducted outside of the defendant's presence, we submit that they were not.
Counsel, before you do that, because this kind of relates to the question of, say, a defective indictment or the transferred intent, jury instructions, can you address that? Opposing counsel was making the point that count two is attempted murder, not attempted aggravated murder. Do you see any problem with the indictment or with the jury instructions in this case related to transferred intent?
No, Your Honor, we do not. In State versus Solomon, this court held where a defendant had been indicted for aggravated murder and attempted murder, where the defendant's intent was to go in and shoot Mr. Glasgow, his wife happened to get in the way, and she was shot and killed in the process, and the grand jury indicted the defendant for aggravated murder on Mrs. Glasgow. However, they only returned an indictment on attempted murder and not attempted aggravated murder for the count against Mr. Glasgow. And this court held that that was fine and that we cannot look into what the grand jury was doing when they returned these charges, but those charges were sufficient in order to return the guilty verdict on the aggravated murder on Mrs. Glasgow. And we would submit that the same circumstances and the same law applies here in this case. With respect to the critical stages of the proceeding, we would submit that the defendant's presence is not required at bench hearings or in-camera proceedings between attorneys and court where the matters discussed are purely law, and that's in State versus Howard. With the exception of certain enumerated decisions, it's incumbent upon a lawyer to make all of the legal decisions within a trial. In Jones versus Barnes, the United States Supreme Court held that there are certain decisions that are left to the defendant, such as whether to take a plea, whether to take the stand, and whether or not he's going to waive the jury. Otherwise, the court held that the attorney's duties is to take professional responsibility for the conduct of the case involving all legal decisions to be made in the trial.
As we know, death is different, and these capital cases are to be very careful. The judge is to be very careful in making sure that a defendant is present at all critical stages. Now, did the judge in this case ask defense counsel if the defendant wished to be present or if presence was waived for what we've been told is a 3.5-hour conference?
I do not believe the record reflects anywhere on the record that the judge did ask if the defendant wished to be present. However, at the same time, there is no record from defense counsel requesting that his client be present at that stage of the proceeding, and therefore we would assert he has waived that issue, as the court suggested earlier, and therefore the court must examine it under a plain error standard at this time. The Sixth Circuit in Meeks versus Bergen has stated that issues such as witness selection, issue selection, cross-examinations, motions and objections, and strategic decisions are all factors that fall within counsel's purview to determine in a case and not within the defendant's own determination. If the court has any other questions on that issue, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I would move on to the Ronnie Trent issue involved in propositions of law numbers 12 and 13. To give the court a factual background as to the timeline of what happened with Ronald Trent, he was arrested for gross sexual imposition on October 14th of 2001. Approximately 6 months later, James Conway was arrested on February 23rd of 2002 for the crime for the murder at Dockside Dolls. Mr. Conway was randomly placed in a cell with Mr. Trent at that time, and the state had played no part in this placement. The state, in regards to Mr. Conway's case, had no idea that Mr. Trent and Mr. Conway would even become friends or know each other. At the time that they were placed in the cell, I believe Mr. Trent testified that they became close because Mr. Trent was dressing Mr. Conway's wounds from a shooting, another shooting that Mr. Trent had not been involved with. Mr. Trent had had no contact with law enforcement at this time, as he testified in the record at page 1819. Mr. Trent testified that Mr. Conway confessed to several things, including the murder that happened at Dockside Dolls, saying that he had done that. He confessed to another murder involving a victim named Andrew Dodson, and he also attempted to enlist Mr. Trent to kill witnesses for him in relation to this case. As payment for these hits, there was evidence that Mr. Conway's brother, Jeff, had put $5,000 into Mr. Trent's commissary account at the jail, and that he was to be paid $30,000 for carrying out these hits once he got out of jail. On April 4th of 2002, Ronald Trent wrote to the prosecutor's office, to Assistant Prosecutor Cheryl Pritchard, indicating that he had information on the Dockside Dolls homicide. A few weeks later, he wrote to her again, and then on April 25th, the sheriff's office, along with prosecutors, met with Mr. Trent to determine whether or not he had credible, viable evidence regarding Mr. Conway and the Dockside Dolls case. At that time, Mr. Trent told about the Dockside Dolls case, told about the Andrew Dodson murder and other crimes, and at that time he was not offered any plea agreement by the state. He did continue to cooperate with the state, and on May 16th of 2002, he did become an agent of the state, where he remained an agent of the state until May 28th of 2002. During that time of May 16th to May 28th, he was released from jail under the guise of being on work release so that he could go meet with friends of Mr. Conway to carry out these alleged hits that were to be completed. And then on June 16th of 2002, Mr. Trent entered into his own plea agreement on his case. Mr. Conway voluntarily made statements to Mr. Trent while he was in jail regarding the Dockside Dolls case. At the time that Mr. Trent became an agent for the state, no more statements were elicited regarding the Dockside Dolls case. And as the United States Supreme Court has held in numerous cases, the Sixth Amendment does not apply for once in all future prosecutions, and that it must be invoked with each subsequent prosecution when a case is commenced. The only charges for which Mr. Conway was being indicted at that time was the Dockside Dolls murder. And at that time, once Mr. Trent became an agent for the state, he elicited no more statements regarding Dockside Dolls. He only elicited statements regarding the Andrew Dodson murder and the hits that were to be carried out on witnesses to the Dockside Doll murder. And then if the court has no further questions regarding Mr. Trent, the other issue that I would address at this time is that the trial court did properly admonish the parties before recessing for the evening in proposition of law number 16. Again, this is a plain error standard, as there was no timely objection made on this issue. The defendant was admonished in the middle of his testimony during direct examination not to discuss his testimony with anyone during the evening recess. There was no objection from defense counsel at this time, just as there was no objection earlier in the afternoon during the 15-minute recess where that same admonition was given. Counsel for defendant never indicated a need to consult with the defendant overnight when this admonition was given. And the court, when asked what evidence they were intending to introduce the next day, counsel and the court discussed that and never again indicated a need to speak with the defendant that evening. Counsel then asked both parties if there was anything else they wanted to discuss a couple of different times, and both times defense counsel said nothing. Somewhere in the record at page 2938, the court, during the motion for a new trial, states that counsel came back into the court in chambers that evening and said, "I'm glad you told me I couldn't meet with my client. The family wanted me to, and I don't want to." At that time, the court indicated on the record, "I did not tell you that. I told him you could not speak with him regarding his testimony." The next day, Mr. Sir came in and asked the court to make a record at 9:20, where he objected as to not being able to speak with his client the previous evening. The court said that that was not the order, and again, that he only instructed him not to talk about testimony. We submit that the objection was not timely. If counsel wished to object to this, he should have done so at the time the admonition was given, to give the court a chance to clarify on the record the instructions for the admonition. And we would further submit then, in Proposition number 17, the defendant was not denied his right to a public trial. At the beginning of the trial, under Rule 615, defense counsel made a motion to separate all non-party witnesses from the proceedings. The appellant seems to be alleging a dual proposition here, somewhat claiming prosecutorial misconduct in this case, and also that the right to public trial was violated. Under Criminal Rule 33A, when making these claims, it is required that the defendant submit an affidavit with attached to his motion for a new trial to support his claims. The defendant did not do this in this case. In the record, it is clear that there is no affidavit attached, and the court may have summarily dismissed his motion. However, the court chose to go ahead and let him present evidence in the motion for a new trial. If alleging that the state purposely excluded people because of malice, the burden is upon the defendant to provide some credible evidence to support this contention. And in the hearing for the new trial, witnesses for the defense, Susan Deering and Gretchen Rose, testified, and then assistant prosecutors James Lowe and myself also testified in the hearing. Ms. Rose admitted while she was testifying that she voluntarily agreed to speak with prosecutors during the trial, and that after she spoke with them, she returned to the trial and maintained her position in the courtroom for the rest of the hearings. She never told the court, the deputies, or any attorneys or bailiffs that she felt she was being threatened or intimidated, and she admitted on cross that she could not recall any specific statements that would have intimidated her from coming back into the courtroom. Susan Deering claimed to have been barred from the courtroom. However, on cross-examination, she admitted that she left the courtroom because defense counsel told her she might be a witness and that she should go ahead and leave the courtroom. If the court views this as a public trial claim, we would submit that the rights of the defendant were not violated. The right to a public trial is to ensure that the defendant has the opportunity to have members of the public in his trial in order to prevent judicial indiscretions and abuses. The Constitution does not guarantee that every member of the public has a right to attend every single trial. And there is nothing in the constitutional language indicating that any individual other than the defendant has the right to be present during these proceedings. And we would submit that the only people that were excluded were based on the Rule 615 motion that were made by defense counsel. If the court has no further questions of me, I will turn the remainder of the argument over to Ms. Day.
Thank you, Ms. Coriel. Ms. Day.
I'm Susan Day, and I will be taking the rest of the time for this argument. With respect to the voluntary manslaughter instruction, I'd first note out that the court did give the jury an instruction on the lesser included offense of murder and also granted defendant's request for an instruction on defense of another. In order to get an instruction on voluntary manslaughter, the defendant must reasonably show, there must be reasonably shown that the defendant would be acquitted of the greater offense and found guilty of the lesser offense. With respect to voluntary manslaughter, the defendant has the burden by a preponderance of evidence to show that he was under the influence of a sudden fit of rage or passion brought on by serious provocation by the victim. There are two tests to be used in determining whether the defendant has presented this sufficient evidence. There is an objective test under which is whether a reasonable man in defendant's position would be seriously provoked.
Why would somebody stabbing your brother not be serious provocation?
Your Honor, I think a reasonable person would be seriously provoked, but that does not eliminate the fact that the defendant secondly must show that he, in fact, under a subjective test, whether that he, in fact, was under a fit of sudden passion or rage.
And you're standing there, and you've got this huge crowd milling around, and somebody stabs your brother, and you got everybody still milling around. You know if he's going to be stabbed again, and you don't engage in a serious fit of passion over this incident?
Your Honor, I think that you have to look at what the defendant said about that, and he specifically rejected that sort of a claim. His testimony was that his first inclination when he saw that his brother was stabbed was to take his brother to his car and get him out of there. At that point, he said, I saw Mandel Williams charging towards my brother. He wasn't that far away from us. He had something in his hand. I couldn't see what it was, and I thought that he was going to attack him again. And so there, I got a gun. I got a gun from Rob or whatever, and I fired only because I was trying to protect my mother, my brother from attack from Mandel Williams. So his testimony at trial was, I was going to get my brother out of there. It was only when I saw my brother in further danger that I acted.
My question is, you know, he's been stabbed once. The guy's coming at him again. Why doesn't that fit the test of serious provocation? I can't imagine anything being more serious. You're putting this in a cold light of day and saying, well, because he had time to actually, if you believe one version, open a trunk and get a gun out, that somehow takes away the sudden rage, the sudden passion when you've got this huge gang and running around and some guy's running at your brother again?
Your Honor, I
can't analyze it in the cold light of day. You have to look at it in the subjective test, as you said, of what was his state of mind.
And I think the only person that really could testify that was the defendant, who did testify as to what his state of mind was. And he said that his actions were self-defense. He got the instruction on self-defense, on defense of another. He was given that. He did receive that instruction, and that is specifically where his testimony went.
I agree, it meets that test, but I'm having trouble understanding why it doesn't meet the other test.
Your Honor, I can only repeat what I've said. If you look at his testimony, that it was in purely self-defense, that he was fairly calm. He wasn't in the fit of rage or passion that would incline him to go after Mandel Williams.
There was no testimony that he was in a provoked fit of rage over the attack on his brother. His own testimony was, it was in defense of another.
Right.
That was my justification, that I was looking out for my brother, so I shot 8 shots at these 2 victims.
Right.
It had nothing to do, so there was no evidence that would have allowed for that type of testimony or that type of jury instruction from this judge.
Yes, Your Honor, that is my argument, and you, of course, said it certainly better than I did, but that is he did not put any evidence that he was in that state. And the only time there was testimony about emotion was during cross-examination by the prosecutor. The prosecutor asked him, were you mad? And he said, yeah, but that wasn't why I did what I did. I did what I did because I was, you know, this guy was coming after my brother and I shot him. So there was no evidence of his being in the sudden fit of passion or sudden fit of rage. And I don't see how you can give the instruction unless there were some evidence of that there. Now, I think you can... You know, I mean, he specifically in his own testimony negated that factor. And
the jury rejected his defense of third person, did it not?
The jury rejected his defense of another, and because it really was contrary to what other witnesses who testified, who other eyewitnesses testified. There was really nothing to corroborate. The other witnesses testified that Mandel Williams was running away along the side of the building and that the defendant went after him. There was no evidence. But the jury also rejected the murder charge. So he was not only did they not believe in the defense of another, they also didn't, again, given an opportunity to find a lesser included offense, they did not. So even if this instruction could be deemed to have supposed to have been given, it wouldn't have made any difference.
So why did he do it?
Why did he do it?
Yeah.
I could give you a person. I think we can just go, you know what he says, you know what he told Ronald Trent.
What was the prosecution's theory at trial? What was its argument? Why did he do this?
I don't, you know, the state doesn't have to prove motive. I think, you know, but he told Trent that his brother had called him, that, you know, they'd been, there was, and there was also corroborating testimony, evidence for this, that they had been in a, there had been an argument the day before, a couple days before, between these two groups of people. He told Trent when he was in jail that his brother called him and told him that these same guys were out there at the, you know, at the Dockside Dolls. And then he went out, he saw his brother stabbed, he said he went to the, he saw that he went to the car, there was a dancer sitting on the trunk of this particular car, he told Rob Myers to get him the gun, they got the, retrieved the gun from the trunk of the car, and then he went after him. And he charged him. He first cocked the gun, and bullet fell out. He fired until he was done.
Let me put my question this way: he either did it in self-defense, or he did it because he was angry, or he did it because.
He did it because he's a cold-blooded killer. I mean, that would be the state's theory.
So for pleasure,
yeah.
In front of 1,000 or 100 witnesses, he decides to.
I think that we're bound by the evidence as presented in this trial, so clearly, you know.
So he did it to show off. That's.
Maybe, you know. I mean, I think that's a possibility. He did it just because he wants to be the big guy and he doesn't want anybody messing with him. You know, we don't have to prove motive. We have to prove intent, that there was purpose in prior calculation and design. And I think we do that. And I think that we can't really know his reasons without his telling us the truth about it.
I'm troubled, as Justice Stratton is, by the failure to submit the voluntary manslaughter charge.
I think you have to look at, I would ask you both to review then his testimony about what his feelings were and why he did what he did, what he said both at trial and his completely contrary statements to Ronnie Trent. And I think that if you look at his testimony at trial, you will find that he didn't testify that he was in a sudden fit of passion or sudden fit of rage. He testified that it was self-defense. And I would ask the court to note that the jury was given the opportunity to find a lesser included in offense, and they chose not to. They found the more serious offense of aggravated murder. And I guess we can agree to disagree at this point, but I really don't see that you can find any evidence that he was under a sudden fit of passion or rage in reading reading his testimony, what he testified to.
So we can't find that, and we can't find that he did it in self-defense. So he did it to show off.
Well, I don't know why he did it. You know, we've never had any access to any psychological evaluations in this case. I mean, nobody ever has decided to present those either one of his death cases, what the psychologists find. I don't know. I'm not qualified to answer that. But I don't think you can find from the evidence that he was presented in this case that he was under a sudden fit of passion or rage, because he simply didn't testify to that.
The evidence shows he fired, was it 8 bullets?
Right. He struck.
He was trying to shoot through Gervis in order to
get Mendel Williams.
Because he thought the .45 would penetrate the first body and get to the second, so he could kill 2 people.
Right. He didn't care.
So the human shield element was immaterial to him.
Right. He felt that he knew that his gun would go through both of them, so it didn't concern him that an innocent bystander was in the way of the
And how many bullets were there that were fired into or through the human shield?
I believe there were 4. I know that both victims had 4 gunshot wounds.
Do you think that shows some specific intent to kill? Is that it?
Oh, I would think that shows purpose, and I think that his actions before that show prior calculation and design.
Thank you.
Counsel, I think we also have to focus on, if you want to
examine closely the defense of the third person, the brother here. I believe there's testimony that the jury found credible that when both victims were rendered immobile, he walked up and discharged another round from the weapon into the tangled bodies.
Right.
Certainly meets the test for purposeful.
Right. I don't think that there's any question that the evidence shows purpose. I mean, he emptied the gun, he was moving closely, and he was only a very few feet away from both victims when he fired the final shots. And even defendant admitted that he emptied his gun. He acknowledged that. I want to address briefly Mr. Grafe's argument about transferred intent, and I think what he was arguing in those assignments of error was that because he was intertwining the counts of the indictment with respect to aggravated murder and attempted murder. And with respect to the aggravated murder, which of course was of Jason, the jury was instructed of all the elements of the offense. They were instructed on prior calculation and design as well as purpose. And they found all of those elements, and they were instructed on a transferred intent with that. It really doesn't matter what he was indicted for in the second count. And I don't think you can really go into speculation. I mean, Mr. Grafe is arguing that, well, with the second count, in the second account, the grand jury must have, you know, considered prior calculation design and not found that it existed in that. And I don't think that you can make that type of assumption or should be making that type of speculation about what a grand jury does or does not do. I can easily see a prosecutor pointing out to a grand jury, well, the penalties for attempted aggravated murder and attempted murder are the same. And so for the same result, if you indict with an extra element, that is just one more element that the state has to prove. And I don't know what happened in this case any more than Mr. Grafe does, but that certainly seems to be a reasonable reason why that it wasn't indicted that way. And I would submit that each count has to stand on its own and that there was sufficient evidence to support the prior calculation based on and the jury was so instructed with respect to the Jason's count.
Mr. Grafe says that Arizona, that Ring v. Arizona is on all, or this case is on all fours with Ring v. Arizona. What's your response?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think the jury made all the findings in this case. The jury was instructed on all the elements of aggravated murder. They were instructed on prior calculation and design and purpose, and they were also instructed on transferred intent. This verdict was all found by the jury. There was no judicial findings whatsoever, and he was sentenced upon the jury's findings in this case. There were no factual findings made by the judge that were not already passed upon by the jury. That would be my response. With respect to the character evidence, victim impact evidence, I would submit that this really doesn't rise to the level of being victim impact evidence. I think that the testimony of Mr. Bechtel was simply that how he met Jason, what they were doing that night, how they wound up at the Dockside Dolls. You did not hear any pleas for based on the suffering of the surviving family members or friends. This evidence is perfectly admissible to show the setting of the crime. And I believe I have 7 seconds left, so if there are any other questions, then I will.
Whoa, 7.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Day. Mr. Grafe, you've saved almost 2 minutes and 40 seconds of your time.
2 minutes and 40 seconds. Thank you, sir. With respect to the first issue, it's undisputed that there was previous animosity between these two groups. One of the witnesses testified that he was aware that they'd been there in the past and they were creating all of this tension themselves. This is a black-white issue. Unfortunately, we have to say that it is. It is. It was a white group against a black group. It occurred inside Dockside Dows, and it spilled over into the parking lot, and perhaps the best witness to describe it is the first witness on the scene. She arrived 5 minutes after the melee. She arrived at 2:40 a.m. and they asked her what it was like, and she said it was chaos.
Counsel, if you're saying it's a racial issue, are you saying this was a racially motivated shooting?
No, Your Honor, it is not a racially motivated shooting, but part of the provocation in this case is the issue of race. There was tension between the black group and the white group. And one of the reasons this is shown is because Mandel Williams, when he's outside, he testified to this. He said, "I went for the first white person that I saw." This was Jeff Conway. He slashed his abdomen. Mr. Conway goes over to the defendant, his brother, and says that effing Negro, except he didn't say Negro, stabbed me. Then they go get the gun and
well, maybe the attack by Mr. Williams on Mr. Conway's brother was racially motivated, but how do you say the shooting was racially motivated?
I'm not saying that the shooting was entirely racially motivated.
Where's the provocation, sufficient provocation here to the defendant based on a racial tension?
Part of the provocation was racial tension. It was a combination of everything. This could not have been worse. You had young males here intoxicated. It's 2:30 in the morning. It's white, black. It's two brothers. One gets stabbed, and the other one gets the gun, or takes it from Rob Myers. So the combination here, the prosecution cites State versus Shane and State versus Rhodes. And Justice Resnick wrote the decision. She said in there that if issues like words, verbal words, stuff like that, that's not provocation. We agree. There's no problem with that. But when it raises the level to mutual combat or using, again, a deadly weapon like Mandel Williams used here, then that is provocation. And this is what occurred in this case. And again, in answer to your question, the race was part of this, but the principal issue here, I agree with you, was the fact that a brother was stabbed. The guy was just Mr. Conway was just a few feet away. He comes back and he says this, and then it goes. The last point is that he did shoot eight times, but every witness in this case says that some say it was four, some say six, some say eight, but every last one of them said it was a rapid succession. There was no stopping. There were no interruptions or anything. It was rapid succession. With respect to the defendant saying,
you've used your time, Mr. Grape.
All right. Thank you, sir.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.